Hello, everybody. This is Dick Wamser speaking, and today, this is an honorable date, is Thursday, the 17th of November, 2005. And I'd like to try to present an autobiography of me, which I have tailored after what I've heard in the past by many others of you who have done this, and it certainly has been inspiring and interesting. I think there may be one or two that I haven't gotten to yet because I've been trying to keep up for ever so long and I get sidetracked. So I kept up with about the first month's worth and then I got busy with other things and it's had to be pushed off to the side. I've got quite a number of them downloaded that I haven't heard yet, but we're going to keep on attacking them one at a time. Anyway, we're going to keep this rather short this time. I'm going to try to make this into three different segments. Not because I'm so wonderful and because I've got so many things to tell you, but so that you can figure out whether you want to hear the other two or not after you hear the first one. Anyway, we're going to start with my school days, because that's rather important. It's a good foundation for the rest of your life, and then we'll go on from there. But I will say initially that when I was growing up, I never dreamed that I would live at a time as I'm living now, when there's just so many things to do and so many opportunities and so many ways of embedding yourself in whatever you choose to do. I've got projects here coming out of my ears. I think if I lived to be 900 years old, I'd never get them all done. I'm sitting in what I like to call my office, which is actually a bedroom in a very wonderfully equipped mobile home. They call them manufactured homes nowadays. It's about 10 feet square, I would suspect, if not within a foot of that. I've got one, two, three, four computers sitting here. I'll be getting another one next week. I've got, I'm sure, close to 4,000 or 5,000 hours of OTR to listen to. I've got a couple hundred LPs. I've got 100 open reel tapes to transfer to digital one of these days if the machines hold out that long. And all kinds of cassettes to transfer to, so everything is just burgeoning here. But anyway, to give you an idea how this is being recorded, since this was an biography and a rather nostalgic trip, I thought I'd be a nostalgic recordist here. Also, Rube Goldberg recordist. I've got two microphones in one hand. Since this will be a mono recording, it probably doesn't matter. But the one microphone is a Sony 105 microphone. The other one is just a generic microphone. And they are going through a Pioneer 1978 vintage cassette deck, which still works great as a cassette deck. And then the output of that is going into a Dell 7500 laptop that's sitting over here on top of my turntable dust cover. So let's start out by talking about the fact that I was born in 1943, right during the war, World War II. And I was supposed to be born on Christmas or thereabouts, and I came on Halloween. I was a bit early. I only weighed 2 pounds and 2 ounces when I was born, and at that particular time, that was a tremendously low weight. But it was very successful because I'm still here. But the upshot of that was that I had too much oxygen in the incubator, which destroyed the optic nerve, and I'm sure many of the others of you who have sent the biographies in have that same problem. I was very sheltered as a child, unfortunately. I was the only surviving child. I had two other brothers and a sister, but they died in infancy. And I was very skinny when I was a kid. I had several eye surgeries before I was 3 years old to relieve pressure in both of my eyes, but I do have the original eyes. They're not prosthetic eyes at all. When I was 4 years old, I had a very bad case of measles, which almost killed me, according to my parents, and I'm sure it was true. Don't remember that much about it, but do remember that I was sick there for quite a while. Didn't feel much like doing anything, and so I didn't. The thing that fascinated me the most growing up, of course, was the radio. We didn't have television until I was 6 years old, so the radio was the only contact with the outside world that we had besides the recordings, of which we had quite a number. That was also about the time radio was really burgeoning and getting tremendously popular, because originally we only had four radio stations in the Cleveland area. We had ABC, NBC, CBS, and Mutual. And there were only one or two independent stations. By 1951, we had eight stations altogether instead of only six. So it really got busy. So that was a very crowded place indeed. I was very fortunate to be able to have kindergarten classes through the radio at our kindergarten school, which was a station called WBOE, which stood for Board of Education. And that was an FM station, which originally came on the air back in 1939. And for those of you who are historians or old enough to remember those things, FM just began to become available before the war. And then after the FM band was 30 to 50 megahertz at that time. And then after the war was over, they changed the FM band to where you find it today. And so the 30 to 50 megahertz radios were no good anymore. Strongberg Carlson, among many others, built radios just after the war, which had both FM bands on them, so you had the best of both worlds until the transition was complete. The original FM band then went to the police radio, which was a lot of fun to listen to, but that's another topic I won't get into. But anyway, the radio didn't just bring us music and news and radio programs, such as the Lone Ranger and many others that you're familiar with, but especially in the car. The radios back then were extremely primitive, and that's another topic I won't get into. But not only did you hear the radio, but you knew where you were, because if you went past a neon sign, the radio would buzz very loudly. If you went under a bridge, this signal would disappear completely and come back again. If you got into a particular area where there was some manufacturing going on, sometimes you had some interference because of that. If a thunderstorm was coming, you heard it on the radio before you even knew that it was going to be coming. So the radio was a very, very interesting concept to a blind person, because it gave them much more information than just the fact that there was music and drama in the air. One of the most amazing, well, two amazing things that happened as I was growing up that I think were kind of funny. You know, a blind person sometimes gets a distorted view of things. Get these mics straightened out so I'll make a lot of racket here. And one of the things that was interesting to me was that we lived near a factory. And, of course, as I said, I was very sheltered, so I didn't get a chance to go out and play in the rain. Didn't get any chance to go out when it was cold or snowing outside, only when it was a nice day. And I would come out into the front yard where this factory was just a few houses away, and the sun was shining. And, of course, everything came from machines. The washing machine made a noise, the vacuum cleaner made a noise, and the mixer made a noise. And, of course, the radio made noises, one kind or another. So I just assumed that that machine was the sun. And sure enough, I came out on a cloudy day one day and the machine wasn't running because it was either a Saturday or Sunday or holiday or something and the factory was shut down. It took me quite a while to realize that was not the sun I was hearing, that was the machine. As I'll mention later in this biography, music was a very important part of our growing up. And when I was 4 years old, people thought I had a lot of musical ability, which of course was not true at all. But I was taught piano in elementary school by a blind piano teacher, which again I could talk for hours on but won't. But anyway, I was given a piano for a Christmas present when I was 6 years old. And that was, well, I just couldn't believe that piano belonged to me. I couldn't believe I had a real piano in the house. In fact, I was so sure that it was going to be taken away that I got up at 4 o'clock the next morning to play it to be sure it was still there. And for some reason, my folks didn't think that was such a good idea. I can't imagine why not. As far as knowing that I was blind, I never did until I was about 6 years old. I'd gone to elementary school by that time, of course, and I was reading the typical elementary type books. And many of these people in the books went to the store. And of course, the reason they went to the store was so they could give the person at the store a quarter and get two 10-cent candy bars and a nickel back. If you only got one 10-cent candy bar, how much change would you be getting back? And my mother and father both worked, but they worked very close to home. And when she got back from work, we had many, many mom and pop stores. We had a department store, we had shoe stores, we had grocery stores. Some of them were just regular grocery stores, a couple of them were butcher shops, and so we would go out and get something for dinner. And one day I asked her why I couldn't go to the store by myself, and she said, "Because you're blind." And I said, "What's that?" So, as I said, I lived a very sheltered life. It took a while before it sunk in. I enjoyed school really well, had a good time in school. We lived in Cleveland until I was 7 years old, and we moved out to an area at that time which was very rural, about 20 miles away, and that brought on a very traumatic part of my life. My parents thought they were doing me a favor by getting me out of the city, you know, where all the potential crime was. Of course, there was some of that, of course, because a lot of people were moving up from the south after the war, and a lot of World War II veterans were rather disgruntled, having a hard time adjusting to the regular civilian life again, so there was something to be said for that, but I don't think it was as bad as they claimed it was. But in any event, the upshot of that was that I had to get up at 6:30 every morning and go in with my mother and father to work and stay at my grandmother's house when you get there maybe 7:15, 7:30 in the morning. And then I'd go to school about 8 o'clock, get home from school at 4, and wait for my parents to get back from work at 5 o'clock or 5:30, whenever they did, and then go on home. And at that point, we had to start the fire in our coal furnace because it had gone out and get the house warm and have dinner. And by the time we got our homework done, it was time to go to bed. So it was kind of a lackluster childhood from that standpoint. I made friends easily in school, and I enjoyed school, as I'd said before. But then, of course, when the summer came and I was isolated, it with no place to go and nobody to talk to, it got to be a pretty lonesome summertime year after year after year. In my case, it was an advantage because it taught me the value of books, and most of these were Braille books. Didn't get into talking books until I was, about 17, I guess, because that was the rule at that point, which I think was a fantastic rule. They didn't want you to have your own talking book machine until you were in high school. Otherwise, you wouldn't learn to read Braille. You just listened to records all the time, and of course, that proved to be a very valid indication of a good educational background, because that's exactly what happened when the students began to get their talking book machines earlier than that. One of the things that we did in school I thought was interesting was to read out loud. Each of us had to do it, usually 20 minutes a day. And it was very good training for me to read out loud. I read rather slowly, not particularly haltingly, but I'd get a word once in a while I couldn't figure out and have to have it explained, or I'd try to sound it out and get through it. We were taught, of course, not at the school for the blind, but in an individual classroom within the elementary school. And I think there were 12 of us in the class at that point. We had our own typewriters, Braille writers. I took typing when I was 10 years old and thoroughly enjoyed that. I wasn't very good at it, but I enjoyed it anyway. And enjoyed the reading, of course. We had music classes, which were divided into two sections. One time it was exercising to music, kind of an early Jack LaLanne, I guess you would say, or an early Richard Simmons, but not to lose weight, but just to get coordination going and understand how different music worked, like 3-4 time and 4-4 time and 6-8 time and so on. And then the other part of the class was in listening to music and understanding different types of music, and this, of course, was classical music, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. I always have enjoyed classical music over any other type because of its complexity and how it's put together, which I'll back up and talk about later in the next installment. But the amazing thing to me was the lady who taught these classes went to different schools throughout the system, throughout the week, and she came to our school 2 days a week. When she came to teach us music appreciation, she brought her own phonograph, a very small, and yet, as I recall, very good-sounding phonograph. And when she turned it on, not only did we hear the music, we heard a local radio station at the same time, so we could listen to whichever we chose. It didn't really matter much. And that brings me to a point that I was going to weave into the story, and that is that back when I was growing up, from the time I was probably 6 or 7 until almost junior high school, and mainly because I was so lonely, I suppose, instead of having a mythical friend, as many people do, I had a mythical radio station that I had put together in my mind. And, of course, it broadcasted my whole daily activity from the time I got up until the time I went to bed. I'm sure thousands of people just jumped up and down waiting to hear this every day. But it was all scoped out in reality because, of course, if I was in a classroom, then it was a network recording, or a network program, rather, because I had other people and other input. And then if I was just riding the bus or eating my food or in whatever, then that was an individually produced program. So I had that all figured out in advance. Come to think of it, I think I did do that in junior high school as well with the same typical parameters going on, except when I went from one class to another, at that point we brought the single classroom concept up through the sixth grade. And then I went to junior high school, and at that point we were mainstreamed in the sense that we went to all the classes in junior high school, but we still had our homeroom, which was equipped with all the special things, talking book machines and Braille writers and so on. And occasionally students from our other classes came to read to us things that were not available any other way. But at that point then, when we changed classes, it was a 3-minute time between each class, and that was when I played a record, so they could get from one class to another. Anyway, enough of that. The thing I liked best was mechanical things and theoretical things. I enjoyed mental gymnastics and mental challenges. I never much cared for very, very abstract things such as chess or Monopoly and that type of thing, but I did enjoy analyzing how things worked and how they were put together and so on, as many kids do. I have two friends that I accumulated in elementary school that I still correspond with to this very day, which I'll talk about later, and many others that I have, of course, has lost track of. There were several traumatic things that happened to me in elementary school. When I came into the fifth grade, there was a girl that came to school that I'd never had met before, and she was from the school for the blind in Columbus, as I remember, but she had moved to Cleveland. Can't remember her last name, but her first name was Linda, and she was really outgoing. She was really a very interesting person to talk to. She just had a lot going for her. She just doesn't jabber and not say anything. She was very intelligent, and she was learning how to type as we were. But there was a difference. She only had one hand. And after about 6 to 8 weeks, she could type just as well with one hand as we could with two. But I found out much later that the reason that she came up to Cleveland was because she had cancer. And the Cleveland Clinic at that time, as it is today, was a very good place for that type of thing to be cured and to be studied. And unfortunately, she just didn't make it. We came to school the first of the year the next year, and she wasn't with us anymore. And then I met another girl student that I liked really well. Her first name was Margaret, and she was very quiet, very reserved, very polite, but very shy. And I liked her really well, too, not because just the complete opposite of Linda, for one thing, but I mean, it was just a personality. You know, many blind people don't have much personality, as you know, because they don't have any reason to. They've never been taught enough to have a personality. But she was. She was a very good, personable individual, and very hardworking, very diligent. And she began to talk rather strangely from time to time, and eventually she died, too. I'm not sure what her problem was, but it was some kind of a nerve disorder that she had, so that was kind of sad. So I knew about death quite early. I guess the trend today is not to expose kids to that because it's too much of a trauma, but I did have access to that. My grandfather and I were very close. He died when I was 8 years old. He had cancer, too. He was a wonderful man in many ways. He was a good carpenter. He was a fair electrician. He was a wonderful machinist. And one of the most amazing things that happened to me was that one time I had been given an old spring-driven phonograph for my 6th birthday. And all of a sudden it began to shake and shimmer all the time. It vibrated almost like the cell phones do today. And for those that are technically challenged, it won't mean anything, but it was a governor that had gone bad, and he rebuilt that for me. It worked great for another 5 years. When I was 8 years old, my uncle bought a tape recorder. And that just fascinated me to no end. It was a Brush. Remember the old Brush recorders back? That was the name of it. Charles Brush, of course, was the man that built the company, which was called, I can't remember now, it was on the tip of my tongue, at Brush Development Company, believe it or not. And I won't get into all that with you unless anybody wants to email me and I'll talk about it. I could talk about that machine all day. That was a wonderful machine. It was a, quote, portable recorder, end quote. I'm over-modulating somehow or other. I'm not sure what I'm doing wrong here. Turn my record volume down just a little. That may help. It was in a wooden case. It was probably a foot and a half tall, maybe 18 inches deep and about 14 inches wide, or maybe 16 inches wide. It must have weighed 40 pounds. It was portable. And the joke is it was portable because it has a handle on it. Well, this one had two handles on it. The handles were on the side. And you opened the top, which was hinged, and that's where the tape was. And then there was a little door on the right-hand side where all your controls were, and then on the left-hand side was another door the same width, and then you stored your microphone, your extension cords, and things in that. And it was interesting because the tape brand was Sound Mirror, M-I-R-R-O-R, quite an interesting name. That was how I got introduced into tape recording, and I just was fascinated to no end by that. And to make that long, long story a little bit shorter, I had that machine given to me when I was 12 or 13, I believe, and it lasted almost halfway through high school, so it ran and ran and ran, and of course the little tag on the motor said oil it every 3 months. I never did that, and among other things I never did, so it probably could have lived a lot longer if I would have taken care of it. When I was in junior high school, TV was pretty popular, but I never much cared for it. I still stuck to the radio. In fact, the radio took on a whole new era for two reasons. First of all, I was able to stay up later, and secondly, I got involved in amateur radio, and I just thought that was amazing. I got books. You know, there was a book that I read when I was maybe 9 or 10 years old called Make Radio Your Hobby. Many people might have been familiar with that book. And believe it or not, just about 5 or 6 years ago, a friend of mine in Michigan gave me a copy. It looked like it just came off the shelf, and it was published in 1941. And I've done some internet research since then, and even the tubes and other parts to those radio kits that were described in that book can be built today, and it was written by a blind man, so I'm sure I could do it if I had the time. But anyway, it was just amazing to be able to listen to people talk all over the country about their hobbies and their interests and how they build their radios and how they put up their antennas and what the kids are doing in school and all kinds of things. And of course, you could hear noises in the background as well, so it wasn't just like a live radio program would be. But the amazing thing to me was that the technique involved, the actual mechanics of building something and then finding out why it didn't work and fix it so it did work. Halfway through junior high school, I was given a crystal set, and that it was not an old one, it was a germanium diode crystal set. But I just couldn't believe that you could attach one wire to a bed spring and another one to the telephone dial. You could hear it 24 hours a day, and anytime you wanted to pick up that little earphone, there was music coming out of it. And for those who never had that experience, the fidelity was incredible because there was nothing to take the fidelity away. Just great audio, so I really got fascinated by that. That was about the time I got my own stereo phonograph, too, and started collecting my own records. That was a big thrill. And, of course, the rock and roll phase was one that I had adopted very diligently. I turned the radio on first thing in the morning, shut it off the last thing at night, 16, 18 hours a day. I'm sure the neighbors just loved that. But in any event, I did grow out of that now to more listenable music, I guess I should say, without hoping to make too many enemies by saying that. Junior high school was a time of, rebelling and asserting yourself and all that kind of rot, especially for a kid like me that never did anything before. I never got into any real trouble to speak of. My biggest bodacious activity was to save my dollars, if I could get a dollar a month or a dollar a week, whatever it was, until I had enough to go to a pawn shop and buy my own radio for, I think, $910 it was, something like that. So that was a real big deal to me then. High school was interesting because when we got to high school, I went to a regular high school and I had to do my own study. They would buy some of the books for me if they were available to me. But then I had to, do my own homework and get my own assignments taken care of. There was nobody looking over my shoulder. We went to a local high school. It was grades 7 through 12, and they had all of 500 students back then. Graduating class was all of 63 people in 1961. And high school was a typical, growing up and maturing type thing and make an idiot out of yourself. One thing I meant to mention about junior high and forgot, which I think the Braille readers will just roll on their sides laughing about, I was a bit on the shy side in junior high school, of course, because of all the changes going on, the rebellion that some of the kids got into, they went overboard with, and so on. And the school we went to was not the greatest in the world. It was getting to be a rather rowdy place because of the neighborhood that it was in. But I remember one time going into a history class, and the teacher was very low-key, very quiet, very self-spoken, until he got mad. When he got mad, the whole place just exploded because he was an army guy, and he just held his temper for so long. When it let go, it sure did. But anyway, I finally was able to start becoming more vocal and participating more and so on, and I started getting excited about history. And so I read a chapter ahead, and the next day I went to class, and I was going to talk to the students about what I'd read about this book they were all supposed to be reading. And I got up there and I told them all about Charles Goody Wright, Goody.5R. Oh, well, what can I say? After high school, of course, during high school, I just loved electronics to the point that I wanted to get into that for a profession. And I was not able to do that, of course, because that was about the time the transition was taking place between solid state and vacuum tubes, and I was a vacuum tube enthusiast. And the counselor that I had at the time, who was not, didn't have any experience with blind people whatsoever, said that he didn't think I could manage that because of the transition. And I guess he was right, because everything began to be integrated after a few years, and it would have been very difficult. The next best thing I wanted to be was a locksmith, because I enjoyed mechanical things so much. And I finally realized that wouldn't work because you'd have to be called out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and maybe get into some scruffy areas, and you had to have someone drive you at that time. It would be very difficult to find someone willing and eager to do it. And even though I was not a very good musician, I did have a very great love of music. And as I said before, I took piano lessons through elementary school, but I was also given a clarinet to take lessons on. I never got very good at it, but it was enough to get me into the band in high school just as a lone star player, I guess you would say. Kind of a last resort type of person. But it was fascinating to me because it showed me how music was put together and how your part, no matter how insignificant, made a big difference if you didn't play it right or didn't play it at all. So that was another great adventure, and I enjoyed that, even though it had some pretty rough spots in it. But that led me to thinking about becoming a piano tuner. I had seen a lot of blind people and talked to a lot of blind people who had gone to college to learn how to be a teacher or some other very high-grade profession, and then nobody would hire them when they got out, and I wasn't about to go through that, and I wasn't about to sit in a factory and push buttons all day. The x-ray technician field was very popular and very lucrative at that point, as was the snack bar program, and I just didn't want to get into that, so I did finally get into piano tuning. I chose that as my profession, and I started piano tuning school in a town called Clearfield, Pennsylvania, in November of 1962. And I graduated in, 1961, and I graduated in July of 1962. I could talk for a whole hour on that too, but I won't, except to say that you usually have to have a very good location for a school and a very good, a good aura about the school for it to be successful. And this was right downtown, so it was easy. I lived in a rooming house about 6 blocks away, and it was very easy to get to. I'd had cane travel by that time, and I was able to get around pretty well. And this building was a converted Moose Lodge, as I recall, either Elks Club or Moose Lodge, one or the other. The cornerstone was 1912. The first floor had a bar on one side and a state liquor store on the other side. And above the bar was our tuning school, and then across the hall was a group of architects, so it could have been worse. But we kind of competed with the bars. Sometimes they were noisy, and sometimes we were noisy. There were about 14 of us taking the course. And, of course, when you get 14 people practicing how to tune a piano all day long, it gets kind of noisy. And sometimes the bar got kind of noisy. So we took turns entertaining each other, I guess you would say. But back in those days, the bus system was very, very popular. And there was a Greyhound bus station about 4 blocks away. And if the wind was just right on a hot summer night, they could hear us practicing, because the school was 9 to 5, but then you had a key to the building. You could always get in and practice later. Not so much the tuning, but the repair work sometimes took longer if you couldn't see what you were doing. They had sighted and blind people there, so you had your choice of how much you wanted to take and so on. And I just took everything I could lay my hands on, or my fingers on, I guess you should say. But the one agent at the bus terminal thought that we were teaching people how to play the piano, and he couldn't imagine why we kept playing the same old song all the time. We had to educate him on that. And I guess that was the time I grew up the quickest, because that was my first experience away from home. And, of course, there are other students my age and others that were much older, so I got a chance to be with all kinds of different people, different personalities and different ages and so on. And I'll never forget that I got there, I believe, end of November, if I'm not mistaken, and I came home on the bus for Easter, I believe it was, in 62. And, you know, I was on my own. I was going to get up in time and buy my bus ticket and get on the bus and get right down there and so on. So I got all packed up, ready to go, and I walked out to the restaurant to have a meal about 10 o'clock at night, and the bus station was about 2 blocks away. And I was all excited about coming home, and I was talking to the waitress and having this, you know, big old 19-year-old, what shall I say, 19-year-old transition there. Got ready to pay for my meal, and I didn't have my wallet in my pocket. And I didn't know what to do, because I must have either left it, got caught in the booth where I was sitting, or I dropped it on the floor and nobody could find it anywhere. Or I left it in my room and I didn't have a chance to go back to my room and get it and come back, because the bus would have been gone by that time. So they trusted me until I got back, and I had better stop and tell people about prices back in those days. That particular meal was a humdinger. I really went overboard on that one. It cost me $2.75. But a lot of the students and I would eat at this one place called Miller's Restaurant. You could get meatloaf, mashed potatoes and gravy, green beans, cup of coffee, and usually a piece of pie for $1.05. That was the good old days. And they had a jukebox in the corner, and the song that kept playing over and over again from one Sunday was Ray Charles' I Can't Stop Loving You. We finally got sick of that particular song. But no air conditioning, just a regular restaurant with a fan in the window. And the very expensive hotel was called the Daimling, Daimling Hotel, and their most expensive meal was like $4.75, so you can see things have changed a bit since then. So that's the end of our little discussion here for the time being, and we'll get this to Larry as soon as I can. Last time I tried to do it with my XP machine, I couldn't get to the FTP site for some reason. It wouldn't accept it, but I think I've got that figured out. I think my pop-up blocker was getting in the way, so we'll try to get this to him. And we'll get you the next phase, which would be my career, my basic career. And then the last one will be probably the last 10 years or 5 years or whatever I decide to make it. So anyway, this will be Dick Wamser signing off from Roseburg, Oregon. And we will talk to you again soonly. My email address is snap, S-N-A-P-P, at computerconnect.net. And we'll be talking to you again real soon. So long for now.